Politics Podcast. Next week, Australians will look back at one of the most significant moments in the struggle for Indigenous rights. August 23 marks the 50th anniversary of the Wave Hill walk-off, when Vincent Lingiari led a group of 200 Aboriginal workers and their families off the pastoral station in protest against the exploitative pay and conditions they were working under. The strike soon morphed into a wider call for land rights, a movement that culminated in legislation driven by Gough Whitlam and delivered by Malcolm Fraser in the mid-1970s. An iconic picture from 1975 shows Whitlam pouring soil into the hands of Vincent Lingiari. To discuss the importance of the Wave Hill strike and Indigenous affairs in 2016, we're joined today by Labor's Linda Burney. In winning the New South Wales electorate of Barton on July 2, Linda Burney became the first Aboriginal woman to claim a seat in the House of Representatives. She is a former deputy leader of the ALP in the New South Wales Parliament and was a minister. And she's been immediately elevated to Bill Shorten's frontbench as spokeswoman for Human Services. Linda Burney, how important were the events of Wave Hill in 1966 to what followed?
The events in Wave Hill were incredibly important and continue to be. I mean, the heroic story of Vincent Lingiari and the Gurindji, I think, is one of the most important stories for us all as Australians. The fact that it started out as an issue around working conditions, that famous saying of the old man, "We will not continue to live like dogs," and they walked into the light when they walked off Wave Hill, were just heroic moments that I think should be fundamental to everyone's education in Australia through the school curriculum. The fact that it then, Michelle, moved from the issue of conditions to what many would call the beginning of the modern land rights movement. And that famous photograph by Merv Bishop of Gough Whitlam pouring sand into the hand of Vincent Lingiari is an image that's iconic for all of us. It led to what was called, as I said, the modern day land rights movement. I can speak of that, about that with a lot of authority from the New South Wales perspective, mm-hmm. because I think it was 83 we got a land rights legislation in New South Wales, which has served Aboriginal people very well right through to today. And, of course, the issues around native title in the High Court came a lot later with the High Court decision in 92, I think it was, 92-93, on WIC. But the inspiration of Vincent Lingiari, the actions of the Gurindji, did something very different. It never had happened in Australia before. The Gurindji, with the support of unions and many others, non-Aboriginal people, came to the South and presented their case about living conditions, about rights to country, rights to culture, and the South and the North came together and over a long period of time eventually delivered land rights to the Gurindji.
Well, it was a decade later, wasn't it, in the mid-70s, when land rights were granted in the Northern Territory, and that was really quite transformational.
Really transformational in the Territory, and just interestingly, and what you've just said reminded me, around about the same time, we had Gough Whitlam handing freehold title of large chunks of Redfern to the Aboriginal community in the inner city of Sydney, what became known, of course, as the Block, that area around Vine, Everly Street. So there were those two things happening at the same time. One, in terms of what you might call land rights because of connection to country that the Gurindji had, unbroken connection to country, and because of economic and social issues, and the fact that in the south down around Redfern, and I do think there's a link, there was the movement of self-determination. You had the establishment of Aboriginal-controlled organisations in the early 70s at about the same time that, of course, finally land rights and decency were delivered to the Gurindji.
Looking back on the land rights movement, do you think that it has delivered what one would have hoped it would deliver, or have there been disappointments?
Oh, the answer to that is yes and yes. It has delivered enormously in some areas, but remembering that there was never a national land rights legislation moved in this place, as I understand it. I think Bob Hawke did promise that back in the 80s.
And then went back on it.
And then went back on it, which, of course, I'm sure he regrets deeply now. It's been up to state legislatures to actually enact land rights in various forms of land rights in different states and territories. And in some states and territories, no legislation. So there's been no national consistent approach until we got the native title legislation, which, of course, you'll remember famously, and I remember you actually at the 97 Reconciliation Convention in Melbourne, when John Howard and Heron and Borbidge were running that dreadful, dreadful, absolutely awful campaign to wind back native title, the famous 10-point plan. And I think that was one of the worst periods in Australian Aboriginal history, the winding back of what the High Court had delivered in the Mabo judgment.
What about delivering better lives for Aboriginal people? Has land rights lived up to its promise in that regard?
Look, I'll speak about New South Wales because I think that's a really good example for what you're asking about. The essence of the land rights legislation in New South Wales was exactly that. It was the capacity for Aboriginal people to claim vacant Crown land and to also set up, as a result of that, financial benefits for the local community. And to be perfectly honest, I don't think it has delivered that as much as we would like after such a long time. There is still abject poverty. There are still not the sort of business enterprises, for lots of different reasons, that you might want to see as a result of land rights legislation in New South Wales. And I think that's the experience right across the country. I mean, you know, there is that element, Michelle, of has it delivered improved living outcomes? And the clear answer is to a degree, but certainly not to the degree that one would have hoped and expected.
And why is that?
Look, I think there's lots of reasons for that. Part of that may be the experience of people running land councils, of the legislation, the nature of the legislation itself. Was it really going to ever live up to what we hoped that it would deliver? And I think in most instances the answer is no, because it's so many pieces of legislation are so restrictive in what you can do with it. I mean, as I said, in New South Wales you can only claim vacant Crown land. Well, there's not much of that left, and what's available is not worth enormous amounts of money. But on the other hand, the notion of land rights from an Aboriginal point of view, LORE, and what it means to us as Aboriginal people, that connection to country, is perhaps not a different thing, but much bigger than the notion of land rights.
The walk-off at Wave Hill was all about wages and conditions.
Yes.
Now, in quite a number of Aboriginal communities in remote parts, the problem is that there's no work to get wages, that people are forced into a welfare cycle. How do you see the best way of tackling that?
Well, I would also just expand on what you've just said there. It's not just remote communities where we see, you know, rates of unemployment of 80, 90%. You go to many of the regional centres in many parts of Australia, and unemployment is incredibly high there. I think of towns like Nyngan, for example. I think of towns like Wilcannia. I think of towns like Dubbo. But unemployment is a major issue right across any community in the Aboriginal world. Why is there such unemployment? In some places, it's inexplicable. I mean, you go to a town like Moree, which is a thriving... And I'm sure there are same places in Victoria, South Australia and every other state. A thriving, large country town with a very high Aboriginal population. You walk into a chemist, you walk into a bank, you walk into a supermarket... Even in communities where the Aboriginal population is higher than the non-Aboriginal population, and you will not see an Aboriginal person employed. You go into the Northern Territory and other more far-flung places, you go into a motel, you go into many businesses, you will not see an Aboriginal person employed. Why is that? Is it that Aboriginal people are not employable in those places? Is it the attitude of the employer or the company that's running that business, whether it's a mining company or a tourist exercise? So I think there's some really hard questions around why Aboriginal people are not employed. And I don't think you can sheet that back to whether land rights has been successful. But I understand what you're saying about drawing the analogy from the Gurindji walk-off about pay and conditions. Well, let's think about what that was historically. Aboriginal men and women, primarily men working in the cattle industry for, you know, tobacco, meat, flour and maybe a little bit of money. Slave conditions, slavery, really.
Well, looking at the employment problem that you've just been talking about, what's the best way of tackling it?
Look, there is not a best way. I always counsel people in working in Aboriginal affairs is the one thing that you've got to have is patience. And you've got to have a long-term view and understand that many of the chronic issues that still plague Aboriginal communities, you know, over decades, will not be solved in an electoral cycle. They won't be solved by a magic bullet flying out of this building in Canberra or Macquarie Street or any other legislation place or parliament. It's solved by the government primarily sitting down and trusting the Aboriginal community and working with the Aboriginal community, knowing that each community is different. Each community has its own history, its own story, and you can guarantee that the issues are well understood in that community and the solutions are there. Often the problem is the inflexibility of government programs trying to bang a square pole into a round hole, and there isn't the capacity or the flexibility or the involvement of the local Aboriginal community in finding what that solution is. And the other thing in a more macro way is that, you know, the answer in essence is better educational outcomes, which is why I've spent my entire career working in the education space. That's difficult. I know there's challenges, but until there is some sort of parity and equity in terms of the outcomes of education for Aboriginal people as the broader community, then we're going to continue to see the issues that we've seen for decades.
If we're talking about towns like Moree or Wilcannia, for example, do you need a more community-based approach which takes in both the Indigenous community and the general community, or do you need a more of an effort from business, or what sort of would you go down in those particular places?
Sure, you need both. People have often asked me the question, do I believe in quotas of Aboriginal people, women, in parliaments? And my answer is generally no, but I do think there is an argument in some of those regional and rural communities for the mechanism for Aboriginal people to be elected and serve on local councils. I mean, it's astounding when you go to many regional and rural communities where there's a large Aboriginal population and no Aboriginal people elected to local government.
But, of course, they could vote for them. They could get the people onto the council when they have the numbers.
That is such a fantastic point, and it's a frustrating point where a lot of Aboriginal people don't vote, are not on the electoral roll, and it really is frustrating because there are such numbers in some places where that block of votes would make an enormous difference. But going back to what your question was, it does require an effort from business, but also the local community and government. And at the end of the day, in many of the places that you and I are talking about, the main provider, the biggest employer, is undoubtedly government, and very often the federal government. But it seems to me in those places there is an absolute argument for federal and state governments to be working more closely in delivery of services and actually having in place deliberate programs to train up and employ Aboriginal people. And I can tell you those programs are almost non-existent. I've seen some great examples where there's been efforts by particular banks or institutions, and many of them have a Reconciliation Action Plan, a RAP, where there is a requirement that there be employment of Aboriginal people. I mean, you think about a large Aboriginal family in any community, particularly remote and regional communities, but also in the city. If there was the employment role models in that family and changing that almost intergenerational poverty and unemployment, it would just make an enormous difference. If you're in a family, whether you're black or white, where someone hasn't been employed for two or three generations, then it's very difficult to engender that in the next generation, and that is the trick. We've got to change and break that intergenerational unemployment and poverty.
And at the family level, what do you think are the main problems and what are the possible solutions? Yeah. Obviously, in some of these communities, drugs, alcohol and so on are making for dysfunctional situations and children not going to school. How do you get some answers here?
Yeah. Look, you know, there are such enormous and awful social problems in many Aboriginal communities. Sometimes you just shake your head and think, you know, what chance, how can a child possibly imagine a future in this situation? And I think that has been the experience of a lot of government agencies. It's been the experience of a lot of the Aboriginal leadership. It's been the experience particularly for families. But it is possible. And the way that I best describe it is that you work at a local level. There's not going to be a change in the circumstance of Aboriginal families if you continue to see it at a macro level. It really is about getting down to each individual community. And it's doable. It's absolutely doable. with the population of Aboriginal people and the number of Aboriginal communities in Australia. There is amazing examples that I don't think we take enough time to look at to see whether there's applicability from one community to another. There's examples internationally that could be also applied. But I also think that, you know, you can't pretend that there aren't problems. You can't pretend that there is not shocking dysfunction, violence, abuse going on, because there is. I would never pretend that there isn't. And there is not going to be an answer for much of that from government. That has to come, as I think you're alluding to, from within the community. And that requires those places where those things are happening a lot of bravery. It's not very easy for one or two women to stand up in an Aboriginal community of a couple of hundred where you're related to a lot of the people and say, this stuff's not on anymore. You would have to be very much protected and looked after if you're going to be that champion. And it seems to me that that's what's needed in many communities, the support of champions and people in every one of those communities that put themselves out, whose door is open, and that's a safe place for kids to go. I mean, how can you have a situation in some places where it's safer for a child to put their mattress on the roof than sleep in the house? It's not like we don't know these issues. It's not like these issues are not being dealt with, but there needs to be more support from government in particular and the non-government sector to assist those people that are prepared to stand up.
And how can that support be given?
Well, it's not just financial. A lot of it is. It's actually, and I know this makes people frustrated, it's actually particularly through non-government organisations going into those communities, establishing a presence, saying this is not a pilot program. We are not going to be here for 2 years. We are going to be here for the long haul, and we will be working side by side with you providing that support, but also developing the skills within that community and the infrastructure, the culture within that community wants to be a safe place. And I'll give you a great example. When I was Minister for Community Services in New South Wales, through a very small grant of $20,000, I think it was, or maybe $50,000, we started a program called Tackling Violence. Now, what that has expanded to is 30 communities with very small amounts of money using the local rugby league team and club as the champions for domestic violence in those communities. Can you imagine how powerful it is? Mm. You give a little football club $5,000 and they take forward, in conjunction with the local men's group, the local PCYC, the local police, the local government, an incredible program of we are the people, we are the men that are going to stand up and say our women and our children are going to be safe in this community. It is peanuts, but it is absolutely working, because rugby league in the Aboriginal community in Queensland and New South Wales is king. And if you can use the people playing rugby league, uncles, brothers, cousins, fathers, grandfathers, as the champions, you can see where I'm starting to come from.
Now, of course, the whole juvenile justice system has been very much in the news in the Northern Territory in recent weeks, and we've seen the Royal Commission set up. Are you satisfied with that Royal Commission, the commissioners, the general terms of reference? Do you think it will achieve something substantial, or should it have been broader?
I was really happy that Malcolm Turnbull obviously had some fairly stern discussions, I'm sure, with Adam Giles overnight, and announced very early on that Tuesday morning that there would be a Royal Commission. I was absolutely thrilled, as many people were, with that. And it was the right call for the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister saw how serious this was and understood what needed to happen. My position, and I think Labor's position, is that we would be very happy, and myself included, if it was broader. And I suspect, Michelle, that as the Commission begins, and we saw it with the Royal Commission into Institutional Abuse, that once it started and started to peel the layers of the onion back, they realised it had to be longer and broader, and I think that will probably happen to this Royal Commission.
You've been critical of the Federal Minister, Nigel Scullion. I just wonder if you could put yourself in the shoes of the Federal Indigenous Affairs Minister. What would be your top three early priorities? What would you do?
My first priority would be to increase the birth weight of Aboriginal babies. Now, people will say, well, what's she talking about? A baby born at a healthy weight has to have good housing, has to have a healthy mum, has to be in a situation where that baby has a chance to be born at a normal weight. For those things to happen, we need to improve a whole range of circumstances for Aboriginal mums, and that would have enormous far-flung effects. I would also want to be looking urgently at the incarceration rates of Aboriginal people, not just young people, but adults as well. I mean, so many people said to me, if only the Royal Commission in 88, the Deaths in Custody Royal Commission, if only those recommendations had been implemented, we would not be having a Royal Commission into the events at Don Dale. The incarceration rates are horrifying. 50% for adults in some states. In some states and territories, almost 100% of kids locked up are Aboriginal children. It's mind-boggling, I think, for all of us. And you think, well, how can that possibly be? Is it the three strikes or the one strike in the Northern Territory? Is it bail conditions? Is it sentencing? Is it the judiciary? Is it the attitude and the actions of police? How much responsibility should be shot home to the parents of these children, which should be substantial responsibility? Is it the educational attainment? What are the things, all of the underlying things that the Royal Commission in 88 into Deaths in Custody examined that put those kids in the, trebled or something, the Aboriginal incarceration rates since that Royal Commission in the late 80s.
Would you add justice to the closing the gap targets?
I was going, you're reading my mind. I understand it was Prime Minister Abbott that made the decision that justice targets would not be part of the closing the gap process. Now, I think it is crucial that the next COAG meeting adds those targets to as part of the measuring of the closing the gap. If not the next COAG meeting, then certainly as a result of this Royal Commission.
We've been talking about quite a few.
That was two. Sorry.
Another one.
My entire life has been around education, and I've always had, and very deliberately, the position that Aboriginal education is about two things. It's about equitable outcomes for Aboriginal people in the education arena, but it's also importantly about all Australians going through the education system, whichever one it is, and having an experience that they end their time at school, knowing the truth and celebrating just how extraordinary we are as a nation with the longest continuous surviving humanity on earth. And I want every Australian to know that and be proud of it.
We've been talking a lot about practical things. If we can just move to the symbolic.
Yes.
It's now clear that there won't be a referendum for Aboriginal recognition in the Constitution next May, which would have been on the anniversary, 50th anniversary of the 67th referendum.
Yes.
The whole process has been pushed out. But do you think now it's ever going to be possible to get that recognition into the Constitution? Hasn't division in the Indigenous leadership, division in the Liberal Party, all these problems in fact made that almost an impossible attainment?
I hate to think that it is an impossible attainment, but I absolutely acknowledge the points that you've just made. I don't want to entertain the notion that it can't happen. I am disappointed, but not devastated, that it won't occur on the 27th of May 2017. That symbolism of 50 years is so important. One of the great joys of my life, or one of the wonderful experiences of my life, has over the last 13 years been attending the Jessie Street annual lunch. And up until recently, Faith Bandler, of course, was one of the chief guests at that lunch, because Faith and Jessie, of course, were such leaders in the 10 years for the leading up to the 67 referendum. And Faith always said, you've got to play the long game. And I think she's absolutely right about this. However, acknowledging what you've said, I am very disappointed that the Referendum Council has now taken the view that they can't deliver a report until, I think it's late or mid next year. I don't quite understand why that is the case, because I believe that if you go out and said to Australians, well, I know that Aboriginal people should be recognised in the Constitution, people say, well, of course. Or aren't they already? They find it difficult to believe that it's not the case. And the other thing, of course, is that this is just not about Aboriginal people. This is about all Australians. The disagreement in the Aboriginal leadership, I'm not so fussed about, because, of course, there was never going to be agreement. It was a nonsense. If part of the framework for having a referendum was unanimity amongst the Aboriginal leadership, if that was part of the steps, then we may as well just forget it, because that agreement is not going to be reached. I am still very optimistic that there will be a referendum. It will not be for the 50th anniversary. That symbolism is lost, but I do think there is still an appetite for a referendum at some point. I am sick of this being kicked down the road. If the referendum council says mid next year, then let's, for heaven's sake, set a definite date so we know what we're working towards, and get a set of words, a question, so we know what we're going to be talking about.
Do you think that the council has just dragged its feet on this?
I am not a member of the council, and I wouldn't say that. But I hope very much that the council, and I, it's full of such extraordinary people. I hope that the council is not allowing its work to be diverted away from what its charter was, and that was to consult on the referendum, seek the views of Aboriginal people and the broader community, and come up with a proposal for government to consider.
So how might it be being diverted?
Well, I think the argument that has been put forward by some, including what seems to be picked up very strongly by parts of the media, is somehow or rather, it's either constitutional recognition or a treaty. Now, that's a falsehood. It's a nonsense to say that you can either have one or the other. And the more that that argument is pushed out, the more difficult it is going to be to achieve a referendum. It is well understood by constitutional experts and lawyers that it is not one or the other, and we're talking about two different things. I can see how that debate is important. I want to see treaties as well, of course I do. And I think in many ways there are treaties being developed and have been developed already in Australia. They're not called treaties, they're called Indigenous Land Use Agreements. They're called different things. But the work of the Referendum Council is about the referendum, and I'm sure that that's what they're focusing on.
Of course, there are some differences in emphasis, at least, between Malcolm Turnbull and the Liberals, who are wanting a narrowly based
yes.
form of words, and your leader, Bill Shorten, who says, well, it's no good going narrow, you must have a
yep.
broader anti-discrimination
yes,
form of words, which I presume is where you're
yep.
coming from.
Yeah.
But won't that be harder to get an acceptable question yeah. from and
I think
get
that,
unity?
I think what you've just described, in essence, I mean, take the argument or the discussion around treaty, or there can't be a treaty, it would have to be treaties with Aboriginal nations. Put that to one side for the moment and let's focus on what you've just said. The view that I have, and I've held this view for a very long time, in fact, I've just spent 6 months ago, 1 month travelling the country and New Zealand with Andrew Bolt, and there's going to be an ABC documentary coming up around this. No guessing what side Andrew was on and what side I was on, but what we're really talking about here is two things, and it's what you've described, and it's what Bill Shorten's talking about, is A, appropriate recognition of Aboriginal people within the Constitution, and the removal from the Constitution the section that still gives capacity to the federal government to enact laws that potentially could be a disadvantage to particular groups of people. Those two things need to happen for constitutional reform, I think, to be acceptable to certainly Aboriginal people broadly, and I suspect to many non-Aboriginal people. Now, you know, I've had discussions, and part one of those, interestingly, was with Adam Giles, and he says, well, why would you take out the capacity for governments to enact enact laws about a particular race? Governments would never do anything that would be disadvantage a particular race of people. Well, sorry, that's happened, and we only need to look at the Hindmarsh Island case that showed that the federal government was quite happy at that point to enact laws that were a disadvantage to particular women in the Hindmarsh Island decision, and the bridge went ahead. So we're really talking about two things, as I said, the inclusion within the Constitution of the truth of the Aboriginal story, and the removal of what's called the race powers out of the Constitution, so that the federal government can no longer make laws that could disadvantage particular groups of people, whoever they are.
One problem, though, if you remove that power, you might end up with the federal government not having power to make laws that yeah. helped Aboriginal
and
people. This was what 1967 was
exactly,
about.
Exactly. And this is where it starts to get complicated. So the argument is that removal would have to be replaced with something, and that otherwise you're going to have real problems, particularly in terms of native title, for example, nationally. So there would be something inserted that said that there was the capacity for the federal government to make laws that would be advantageous to particular groups of people.
You mentioned your tripping about with Andrew Bolt. I can't finish without asking you how that went.
We did not have one argument. I don't think we agreed on a whole... Well, we agreed on quite a few things. The proposition was that... And I think it's being screened in October. The proposition was something like, well, can we change your mind? I think there was movement both from Andrew and myself on what our very firm positions were at the beginning of that exercise. He was incredibly charming, incredibly well-mannered, but I think by the last day we'd had enough of each other. So we'll see what the documentary says.
I'm sure it'll be fascinating viewing when it comes. Linda Burney, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all from our Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back with another interview very soon. I'm Michelle Grattan. Thanks again for listening.